By the time Thomas Spurgeon resigned on grounds of ill health in 1908, 2,200 persons had been received into the church during his 14 happy years. Despite the figures just given, Fullerton speaks guardedly of decreasing membership. In a private letter to a friend in 1902, Spurgeon's son wrote, "There have been many and sore trials, and I have been depressed beyond measure. Truth to tell, I am at this present time not altogether jubilant. The difficulties are enormous, and they seem to increase. My one dread is of remaining in a post of honor longer than I should." After Thomas Spurgeon's resignation, the pastoral charge was undertaken by A.G. Brown. Though 10 years younger than C.H. Spurgeon, Brown had been close to him and had conducted his funeral. He probably had a better understanding of Spurgeon's ministry than any of the other occupants of the pulpit after 1892, and in T.L. Edwards, an assistant appointed in 1908, he had a like-minded colleague. This was, however, to last only 3 brief years. Brown resigned in 1910, and the following year, with the appointment of Amzie Clarence Dixon, the tabernacle succumbed to the full impact of American fundamentalism and its own brand of evangelicalism. Dr. Dixon came straight from 5 years ministry at Moody Memorial Church, Chicago, where his biographer tells us, in the course of each year, from 500 to 1,000 professions of conversion had been noted on the books of the Moody Church. With his coming, any lingering distinction between Spurgeon's ministry and the Moody ethos seems to have been obliterated. A grand piano was installed, and singing the gospel along with public appeals for decision and the inquiry room system all became part of the everyday life of the church. The occasional and the irregular had at last become the commonplace. Dixon himself was aware that he was inaugurating changes. Before he took up the regular pastorate in London, he had spent some weeks preaching at the tabernacle early in 1911 and gave the following interview on his return to the United States. "Did you hold an after meeting as you do in Chicago?" asked the advance representative. "Yes," replied Dr. Dixon, "and I want to tell you a remarkable thing about it. I conducted the first after meeting ever held in Spurgeon's Tabernacle and continued every Sunday night as long as I was there. Had 15 conversions the first night, 30 the second, and the number ran as high as 35 to 40 some evenings. Didn't they take to your methods?" "I can't say that they did at first. My methods were too American, but they warmed up to them later." "What were your first impressions of a London audience?" "At first they seemed rather stolid. The weather was chilly. Perhaps that had something to do with making the people seem chilly. But after the ice was broken, they were the most enthusiastic lot you ever saw." Enthusiasm could be taken as the key word for the opening of Dixon's London ministry, and the spirit was soon conveyed to others. One Christian paper commenting on the tabernacle wrote on signs of a revival, giving the information that the lower gallery was once more in use on Thursday evenings. To a representative of the South London Press who interviewed Dr. Dixon in his vestry, he disclosed the hope that there would be a revival that would shake South London, apparently supporting his feeling by a statement on the number of inquirers who had recently confessed faith. In the summer of 1912, when Dixon was one of the speakers at Keswick, there was further excitement over great advances to be made at the tabernacle. The Christian Age for July 5, 1912, commented on Dr. Dixon's amazing proposal for the conversion of the Elephant and Castle into an evangelical beehive. But there was a trace of skepticism in the reporter's words. All credit to Dr. Dixon for his big ideas. The £100 he wants however, does not include the great buildings which would take the place of the elephant or the maintenance of them, and one wonders whether another expensive central mission here is really necessary. It is not easy to assess the spiritual fruit of Dixon's 8 years in London. The great rebuilding project never materialized. It is indeed unmentioned by Dixon's biographer, his second wife, Helen C.A. Dixon. But according to Mrs. Dixon, there was certainly revival. In a campaign in 1912, more than 300 confessed their decision for Christ. In 1915, Dixon covenanted with some of his members to try to win at least one soul for Christ every week. And in a service in May of that year for continental refugees, in a single meeting, 27 French people decided for Christ. The next year, Dixon helped to lead the 6 months long Jubilee campaign of the London Baptist churches, and he wrote of tokens of great revival at the tabernacle. In 1912, when there was a 5 month trench campaign and a gospel picture mission, more than 700 people accepted Christ. The tabernacle, wrote Dixon towards the end of 1918, was never in a more prosperous condition. Yet, at that same date, Charles Noble, an old member of the tabernacle, wrote a very different account of the condition of the church. See the appendix to this volume. There is no suggestion in Dixon's biography that criticism existed of his pastorate at the tabernacle, though in a letter of 1917 to his first wife, discussing whether he should remain at the tabernacle, he wrote, "It looks as if God wants me to stay right here and witness for him, though I can see it will mean opposition, if not persecution and suffering." A.C. Dixon, 228. The meaning of this statement, his biography, does not explain. An account which the present writer has heard confirmed by others who also belong to the congregation and whose memory went back to that period. Dixon's ministry illustrates how different from Spurgeon's was the new evangelical outlook. In the vocabulary of the Puritan school, revivals were extraordinary manifestations of the power of God, and by definition, not produced by human labor. But under C.G. Finney and later Moody, so many results attended campaigns that these also came to be spoken of as revivals. Indeed, Finney deliberately treated evangelistic endeavor and revivals as synonymous and encouraged the philosophy of the more effort, the more revival. This was the thought pattern of Dixon's background, put into words by his own father in the advice he gave him on going to his first pastorate. "My son, have as many prayer meetings and revivals as you can, and as few church meetings as possible." But unlike the old revivals, the yardstick of campaigns was not primarily the evidence of the changed lives, admitting men and women to the discipline and duties of church membership. It was, more simply, the number of decisions. To obtain decisions, an opportunity for a public response to the message was essential, and this practice thus became the practically universal hallmark of evangelistic preaching. "He always closed his sermon with an appeal to accept Christ," wrote one observer of Dixon, and another recorded him this testimony. "Evangelism was the passion of his life. Even after lecturing on Abraham Lincoln, I heard him close with an appeal, and souls came to Christ." Mrs. Dixon, speaking of her husband's evangelistic preaching, refers to a criticism made by a deacon in one historic church where her husband was pastor. The phrase and nature of the story point to Spurgeon's tabernacle. The deacon's criticism was allayed, we are told, in this manner. Next Sunday, the Spirit of God touched his heart, and the dew of heaven fell upon the church. For the first time in the memory of anyone present, there were conversions at the morning service. Five persons responded to an appeal for decisions. To write in this fashion indicates how oblivious Mrs. Dixon appears to have been to Spurgeon's oft-repeated warning that decisions and conversions might well be two different things. The evidence of the frequently large number of supposed converts under the new type of evangelism whose Christianity proved short-lived ought to have been sufficient proof of this. A writer who belonged to the old evangelical school gave this report in the Signal, July 1, 1884, on the common results of the new methods in Scotland. An evangelist gave as the report of 2 weeks' meetings in connection with a church, 60 saved. Might I ask the reader how many he supposes of these 60, 3 months after, made even a profession of Christianity? We are sorry to say, not one. We suppose while the church on earth lasts, we must look for the fulfillment of the Lord's parable of the four kinds of ground, or rather the four samples of ground, in different states of preparation for the seed. But we never saw the stony ground and the trodden ground and the shallow ground in such proportions as we see these now. Those Scottish church leaders who gave their approval to Moody never foresaw this consequence of his public appeal, though they had misgivings about it at the time. John Carnes, for example, commenting on Moody's work in Scotland, wrote, "The only feature that all might not approve of has been the coming forward of persons to be prayed for. Yet I have become used to this, and everything else is so decorous that I am satisfied and even thankful." Life and Letters of John Carnes, A.R. McEwen, 1895, page 7. 21. But such was the evangelizing fervor and the impatience with doctrinal definitions that few stopped to question whether the numbers responding to appeals were a true indication of spiritual realities. We have thus considered something of the history of the tabernacle after 1892. It remains now to be asked how such a change was possible at the very center of Spurgeon's work. To the present writer, there are three reasons which stand out. First, the influences which brought the change were at work in Spurgeon's own lifetime, even in the wider circle of some of the institutions which he had commenced. Practices and methods had gained a footing which he had not authorized and yet which he did not forbid. The most notable instances occurred in the Pastors' College Society of Evangelists, an organization which began as an offshoot of the college in the 1870s for special evangelistic effort in needy parts of the country. Among the men who served in this society, the most prominent were C.H. Spurgeon's evangelists, Fullerton and Smith. According to Fullerton's later account, he was the main speaker in the mission services while J. Manton Smith's gifts lay in the telling use of anecdotes, in his skill with the cornet, and in his singing. I recognize that it was Manton Smith who attracted the people to whom I preached. At first we used to rest on Saturday evening, but at length, resting on the Friday, we invented song services, selecting a number of pieces with a consecutive bearing on one subject. This made a great popular appeal and gave my colleague ample opportunity to use his special talents. W.Y. Fullerton has given us his autobiography in his volume, At the 60th Milestone, converted as a teenager in the old-fashioned Presbyterian church of his Belfast childhood. He discovered his life's work when Moody and Sankey came to that city in 1874. of their mission at that time, he writes, those to whom such movements are familiar can have no conception of the revolution that can be made in a young life by such a ministry. Thereafter, going to London and to Spurgeon's College, he took up itinerant evangelism himself and was wholehearted in his adoption of the new methods. The belief that music is an essential attractive influence, the appeal for public decisions for Christ, the apparatus of the inquiry room, and the subsequent announcement of numbers. All these were features of Fullerton's ministry, as the reader of his autobiography will soon discover. It is not altogether clear how far all these things were common in the society of evangelists before Spurgeon's death. Significantly, a recommendation of the methods of C.G. Finney did not appear in the columns of The Sword and the Trowel until the year after Spurgeon's editorial pen was laid down, when A.A. Harmer, another member of the same society, wrote, "The evangelist of today may learn much from the methods adopted in revival work by Mr. Finney. Nonetheless, some evidence of a departure from Spurgeon's own position is to be found in the notes of the same magazine which report the work of the Society of Evangelists before 1892. The secretary of the Bradford YMCA, for instance, informs the readers of The Sword and the Trowel, December 1890, that in Fullerton and Smith's recent services, 350 anxious inquirers were personally dealt with in the after meetings. Of another Fullerton mission in the same year, we read, every night of the mission, souls were saved, and such a scene as that witnessed last Sunday night, when about 100 filled the inquiry room, made our hearts sing for joy. Why then did Spurgeon permit these things in the circle where his word might have been decisive? Without doubt, one consideration which made him tolerant was that the evangelists were earnestly set upon soul-winning. Their motives he did not doubt, and if their theological understanding was not strong, he remembered that God gives different gifts to men. Furthermore, much of this special evangelistic work was not regarded as public worship. The age in which mission halls, theaters, and other buildings were the venue for evangelism had begun, and Spurgeon always had sympathy with attempts to reach the masses by any means. In a sense, he had done this himself in earlier years. In what was plainly a reference to Moody and Sankey, he had said in 1873, I do not hesitate to say that a great deal of church order and a great deal of propriety and decorum and regulation and, as it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, ism, are only so much spices and linen for a dead Christ. And Christ is alive, and what is wanted is to give him room. I do not say this for my own sake, am I not always proper, but I say it for the sake of earnest brother evangelists. Spurgeon was prepared to caution men against the too frequent employment of special services, but in principle he accepted their usefulness. What was left unclear by all parties at the time was the question how far such meetings should be regulated by the same principles which governed the regular worship and activities of the church. If the new evangelistic methods had, at the outset, been proposed for introduction into the regular services of the churches, there can be little doubt that they would have been widely opposed. The fact is that they gained their ascendancy in another sphere. The work of Moody's friend, F.B. Mayer, pastor of Christ Church, a congregation not far from the tabernacle, illustrates the common pattern. In an effort to reach non-churchgoers, Mayer began at the end of 1893 to hold special meetings for men designated a pleasant Sunday afternoon. Here, unlike his church services, there was band, choir, and organ. In addition, the meeting was regarded as informal, and even applause was not out of place. Nonetheless, there was an order which Mayer tells us was as follows. 3:30, hymn. 3:35, reading of scripture, about 10 verses by a selected brother. 338, Anthem or Hymn with Chorus by the Prize Choir. 343, Prayer, followed by the Lord's Prayer, led by a brother. 345, the first solo. 350, the notices by the secretary. 353, the chairman. Always, when at all possible, myself. 4 o'clock, hymn. 405, our speaker for the afternoon. 425, the second solo. 430, exhortations to sign the pledge and decide for God, followed by the last hymn. 435, a short prayer. Reveries and Realities, or Life and Work in London, F.B. Mayer, 51. When Mayer went to Christ Church, W.Y. Fullerton was appointed to his former charge, Melbourne Hall, Leicester. Fullerton subsequently became Mayer's biographer. In that volume, as in his biography of Spurgeon, Fullerton fails to give any indication of how far the evangelicalism of the early 20th century had drifted from Spurgeon's position. When the Spurgeon biography came out in 1920, H. Tideman Chilvers, who was then pastor at the Tabernacle, criticized Fullerton for writing in such noncommittal terms of the downgrade controversy and not boldly in advocacy of Mr. Spurgeon's attitude, quoted in A Centennial History of Spurgeon's Tabernacle, Eric W. Hayden, 1971-43. But Fullerton's whole printed treatment of Spurgeon, in its poverty of theological understanding, merits censure. Some of the things Spurgeon cared for most, Fullerton, by his silence, allowed his readers to forget. Those willing to become Christians, Mayer writes, were exhorted to go to an area of the church named Consecration Corner. It is not the case, however, that Spurgeon's attitude to these things was simply one of forbearance. He gave repeated warnings against the new trend. As early as 1875, he expressed concern lest the Moody and Sankey practice should create a new traditionalism. We are all too apt to get into fine harness and tie ourselves up with rules and methods. Why, dear me, if we are to have a special service, one brother must have it conducted on the Moody method, and another can only have Sankey hymns. Who then are we that we must follow others? Do not talk to us about innovations and all that. Away with your rubbish. The readiness to regard music as a vital part of evangelism, he also condemned. Dear friends, we know that souls are not to be won by music. If they were, he goes on to say, it would be time for preachers to give way to opera singers. In 1882, he declared, the heaving of the masses under newly invented excitements. We are too apt to identify with the power of God. This age of novelties would seem to have discovered spiritual power in brass bands and tambourines. The tendency of the time is towards bigness, parade, and show of power, as if these would surely accomplish what more regular agencies have failed to achieve. Again, in 1888, Jesus said, preach the gospel to every creature. But men are getting tired of the divine plan. They are going to be saved by the priest, going to be saved by the music, going to be saved by theatricals, and nobody knows what. Well, they may try these things as long as ever they like, but nothing can ever come of the whole thing but utter disappointment and confusion. God dishonored, the gospel travestied, hypocrites manufactured by thousands, and the church dragged down to the level of the world. Equally strong were his words against the system of getting those under concern to make some public step which would commit them or bring them to the attention of personal workers. He never adopted the practice himself because he believed that sinners must deal directly with God. Once the gospel was plainly preached, all the counsel which seeking souls needed could be given in such words as these: "You have not far to go to find him. Cover your eyes and breathe a prayer to him. Stand behind one of the columns outside, or get into the street and let your heart say, 'Savior, I want peace, and peace I can never have till I have found thee. Behold, I trust thee. Manifest thyself to me at this moment, and say unto my soul, I am thy salvation.' Even so, if others would occasionally appoint an after meeting or an inquiry room, he did not condemn it, provided that it was not treated as a necessary part of evangelism." In the closing years of Spurgeon's life, he was alarmed lest some of his own men were not seeing the dangers. Speaking to his students and to the members of the Pastor's College Society of Evangelists, he said, "In our revival services, it might be as well to vary our procedure. Sometimes shut up that inquiry room. I have my fears about that institution if it be used in permanence and as an inevitable part of the services, and again to the same men. It is a fact that thousands of persons live close to our notable sanctuaries and never dream of entering them. Even curiosity seems dulled. Why is this? Whence this distaste for the ordinary services of the sanctuary? I believe that the answer in some measure lies in a direction little suspected. There has been a growing pandering to sensationalism, and as this wretched appetite increases in fury, the more it is gratified. It is at last found to be impossible to meet its demands. Those who have introduced all sorts of attractions into their services have themselves to blame if people forsake their more sober teachings and demand more and more of the noisy and the singular. Like dram drinking, the thirst for excitement grows. At first, the fiery spirit may be watered down, but the next draft of it must be stronger, and soon it is required to be overproof. The customary gin drinker wants something stronger than the pure spirit, deadly though that draft may be. One said as she tossed off her glass, 'Do you call that gin? Why, I know a place where for 3 pence I can get a drink that will burn your very soul out.' Yes, gin leads on to vitriol, and the sensational leads to the outrageous, if not to the blasphemous. I would condemn no one, but I confess that I feel deeply grieved at some of the inventions of modern mission work." His sermons contain many similar warnings. If you want to get up a revival, as the term is, you can do it, just as you can grow tasteless strawberries in winter by artificial heat. From the preceding paragraphs, it may be seen that there was a certain ambivalence in Spurgeon's attitude to the new evangelistic approach. His warnings were clear, and their emphasis strengthened towards his death, but he was generously prepared to overlook a good deal in some of his workers, and as he had not insisted on a stop to the methods which troubled him, those who were using them were not publicly seen to be in disagreement with their leader. The popular current was running strongly in favor of the methods which claimed for gospel preaching results more immediate and more numerous. In his later years, Spurgeon was becoming increasingly isolated in his adherence to the simplicity of the old approach. To most people, the change from the old to the new seemed as natural as a change from gaslight to electricity, and once the pastor of the Metropolitan Tabernacle was gone, there was no prominent voice left to tell them why the old was better. A second reason for the failure of the Metropolitan Tabernacle to stand by Spurgeon's position may be found in the prevalence of American influence between 1891 and 1919. That is, from the time of Pearson's arrival to the date of Dixon's resignation. Even in the pastorate of Thomas Spurgeon, we have noted how strong was the influence of D.L. Moody, and it was the same son who heartily approved of Dixon's call to the tabernacle. Dr. Pearson had likewise urged Dixon's appointment, sending to Deacon Olney the message, "Trust God and call Dixon to the pastorate." There is an explanation for the ascendancy of this United States leadership in Spurgeon's charge, and it is related to the way in which the last years of his life were dominated by the downgrade controversy. In that controversy, the abject weakness of many of the English Free Church leaders was plainly revealed, and Spurgeon's distrust of the Baptist Union had been openly registered. The circumstances of this painful situation encouraged Spurgeon to put a premium on friends whom he trusted to stand by the Bible as the Word of God. And in men such as Pearson and Moody, he saw sympathetic allies in the battle against infidelity, with the survival of supernatural Christianity itself at stake in the pulpits of England. Spurgeon was ready to welcome help from men who, though they might not be committed to historic evangelical Calvinism, were upholding fundamentals. His emphasis in the face of the threat from higher criticism was for unity of those free from rationalism and superstition. Partly in the interests of this wider union of Bible believers, Spurgeon insisted, as we have noted, that the downgrade controversy was not over the truths of Calvinism. This opened the way to the American alliance. It is hard to assess how far Spurgeon was conscious of the fact that the American preachers who followed Moody to England were closer to the school of Finney than to the classical American evangelicalism of Jonathan Edwards and the Princeton men. After all, generally he never heard them preach. Yet notwithstanding any measure of doubt which he may have had respecting their intelligent commitment to the Reformed confessions, he wanted their fellowship in opposing the danger of the hour. Speaking of this transatlantic link, Helen C.A. Dixon wrote, "A constant interchange of preachers and evangelists was doing much in those days to weld the evangelical believers of England and America together in opposing the destructive teachings of the new theology." Dixon first visited England and met Spurgeon at the Tabernacle in 1889. The encouragement which Spurgeon gave to the American Alliance and to broader evangelical fellowship was not, however, an encouragement to church unity, irrespective of Calvinism. In a letter to a ministerial friend in 1889, Spurgeon wrote of maintaining a common front with General Baptists, who were evangelicals, though perhaps Arminian. "There is a vital difference between us and the downgraders, but there is a clear evangelistic platform upon which we can stand with GBs." However, in the same letter, he also says, "I do not see how we who are Calvinistic can become pastors of avowedly Arminian churches." Letter to Mr. Mills, March 1, 1889, copy at Spurgeon's College. In regular church work and teaching, he recognized there was a serious objection to Calvinistic truth being weakened for the sake of unity. It would have been unthinkable for him to have approved an Arminian pastor at the Tabernacle. Little did he anticipate that in befriending the American visitors and in giving the impression that in all important respects they were one, he was in some measure preparing the way for the establishment in his own pulpit of a tradition alien to his own. The Catholic spirit in which Spurgeon welcomed fellowship with Christians of another evangelical school surely needs no defense. Where he did, we believe, miscalculate was in not foreseeing that out of this alliance formed in a temporary crisis, a permanent new form of evangelism was to emerge. He regarded Moody as a man who was making a contribution to evangelicalism. He did not assess the extent to which the whole evangelical outlook for a long time to come was to be influenced by Moodyism. In this misjudgment, Spurgeon was not alone. As late as 1903, David R. Breed, in an article on the new era in evangelism in the Princeton Theological Review, a bastion of Reformed orthodoxy, took a similar line to Spurgeon. He commended Moody, but criticized Moodyism. Moodyism meant much that was intensely earnest, vital, and evangelical, but it meant much also that was crude, mistaken, and divisive. In course of time, the defects began to involve its decay. Mr. Moody himself seemed to realize this. The same writer goes on to speak of Moodyism as a thing of the past. This assessment was profoundly wrong. 20th century evangelicalism on both sides of the Atlantic was to be a movement in which all that was distinctive of Reformed Christianity dwindled out of sight. It was to be the evangelicalism of the fundamentals, the name of the 12 volumes which Lyman Stewart and A.C. Dixon started publishing in 1910, of Keswick. Spurgeon regarded the higher spiritual life teaching which inspired the Keswick Convention as founded upon an error and therefore productive of an unbiblical strain of piety. O wretched man that I am, said the Apostle Paul, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? He said this not because he was not a saint, but because he was so far advanced in the way of holiness. Metropolitan Tabernacle Pulpit, 24:436. Some say that they live very near to Jesus. It is an evil sign when men speak of their own attainments. I like to be with God's people of the poorer class and of the more struggling and afflicted sort. I like to be with God's people who wrestle hard with sins and doubts and fears. If I get spoken to by my superior brethren, I find I have very little pleasant fellowship with them, for I know nothing about their wonderful experience of freedom from conflict and complete deliverance from every evil tendency. I have never lived a day, but I have had to sorrow over my imperfections. I tell you solemnly that the talk which we have heard lately about perfection in the flesh cometh of ignorance of the law and of self. God's children sin, for they are still in the body. If they are in a right state of heart, they will mourn over this, and it will be the burden of their lives. Oh, that they could live without sin. It is this that they sigh after, and they can never be fully content until they obtain it. They do not excuse themselves by saying, I cannot be perfect, but they feel that their inability is their sin. They regard every transgression and tendency to sin as a grievous fault, and they mourn over it from day to day. They would be holy as Christ is holy. The will is present with them, but how to perform that which they would, they find not. In this respect also, T.A. Pearson was in marked contrast to Spurgeon. His biographer writes, he had become familiar with Keswick teaching, as it is commonly called, before he ever visited Keswick. In the year 1895, he had learned from experience the purpose and power of God to transform character and to give victory over every known sin. Thereafter, he was a popular speaker in Keswick circles on both sides of the Atlantic. Arthur T. Pearson of the Schofield Bible, on the part which the interpretation of prophecy played in forming the fundamentalist ethos, see Ernest R. Sandin, The Roots of Fundamentalism, British and American Millenarianism, 1800 through 1930. The reader will also find more on the history of A.C. Dixon in this volume. Spurgeon's views on prophecy and his opposition to dispensationalism I have discussed in an appendix to my book, The Puritan Hope, 1971. And of the evangelistic campaign with its apparatus for decisions. To the credit of this movement, it must be said that it opposed modernism and believed in taking the gospel to the masses. But on the debit side, its condemnation is that it ignored so much of the historic Christian heritage. It went after new fads, for instance, dispensational premillennialism, and the teaching that the believer is by faith to receive the fullness of the Holy Spirit and thus pass from carnal Christianity to victorious living. In general, it bred a generation in the evangelical churches who loved anecdotes, humor, and music, but knew next to nothing of theology and confessions of faith. All this happened because the doctrine of God had been supplanted from its central position in the biblical revelation, and consequently the true Christian vision of the glorification of God, that God may be all in all, passed from view. Evangelicals began to think and speak as though the message of salvation was not the gospel of God, and as though Christ alone is to be the object of faith. Spurgeon noted this danger as early as 1879. Nowadays, there appears to be in some minds a forgetfulness of the Father. Christ is loved, for he died, but many seem to look upon the Father as having no share in the wondrous work of redemption. This lack of theocentric belief came to have a serious effect upon the content of the gospel message. Too often forgiveness was presented as though that, rather than knowing and glorifying God, was the end of salvation. Similarly, the manner in which the message was presented to men underwent a change. In their eagerness to win men to Christ, evangelists tended to overlook the fact that for sin to be measured in its true light, men must know that they are creatures dependent upon and obligated to the Creator. In the interests of successful evangelism, the emphasis was no longer upon the declaration of the character of God and the claims of His holy law, but upon encouraging men to open their hearts to Christ.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.